Well, amid all the bleak environmental news, here are some positive signs. Salmon, birds, beavers, and even whales are making a comeback in the Burrard Inlet. And that's in part thanks to a process called rewilding. It has many definitions, but essentially it's about restoring environments to a more natural state. Now, it's the subject of a recent book by a BC author and an ambitious project from Yellowstone National Park to the Yukon Territory. American biologist E.O. Wilson is also sparking a debate with his forthcoming book about rewilding, and it's called Half Earth, Our Planet's Fight for Life. Right now, we want to hear from you. What examples of rewilding have you seen in your community? And how much of our money and resources should we commit to rewilding? And how much land should we set aside for nature? Call us now around the province, 1-800-825-5950. In the Lower Mainland, 604-669-3733. And on your cell phone at star or pound 690. You can also tweet us at BC Almanac. Joining us in studio is a professor who was involved in the Burrard Inlet Restoration Pilot Program. Ken Ashley is the director of the Rivers Institute and an instructor in ecological restoration at BCIT. Good afternoon.
Welcome
to BC Almanac. Thanks so much for being here. I was thinking of this subject last night as I was walking through just one of our urban parks here in Metro Vancouver, looking up at the Douglas firs and thinking, what more could we have here if we were to rewild it? So can you define exactly what rewilding is?
Yes, rewilding was a term that emerged in the mid-1990s, and it basically talked about restoring large tracts of land and introducing large top predators to the land so that you could get the natural ecological function that would happen when you had large predators on the landscape, and then allow other natural processes like fire and flood to occur.
Mm. So when we look at what you've done in the Burrard Inlet, can you describe the work you've done there?
Yeah, that would fall more under ecological restoration and rewilding, they get fairly close. And
right.
Ecological restoration is a broader term, which doesn't necessarily imply adding large predators to it, but it's essentially trying to restore damaged, degraded, or otherwise altered ecosystems.
And the damage that you're talking about comes from an oil spill back in 2007, I believe.
The funding that came to fund the Burrard Inlet Project came from the oil spill funding in 2007 that was sent via creative sentencing to the Habitat Conservation Trust Foundation. But there wasn't that much oil on the ground there. Mm. It's just that the funds, which was a significant amount, $447,000, was just then put available for anybody that wanted to do rewilding or ecological restoration projects in Burrard Inlet.
So tell me what you've done there.
Well, the board of the HCTF made the funds available, and a variety of NGOs on the North Shore applied for the funding. And estuaries became the center of the focus because they're a critical link between freshwater and saltwater. So I went to my program head at BCIT, Doug Ransom. I said, here's a great opportunity that we can get our students involved, learning in a real-life project, and that this funding's there, and there's partners on the North Shore wanting to do things. And so various groups applied for the funding, and then BCIT ecological restoration students and instructors have been involved in the process on each of the four estuaries in the North Shore, Mosquito Creek, McKay Creek, and Lynn Creek and Seymour River.
Okay, so has it involved, digging up the soil, putting in some native plants? What exactly have you done physically?
First thing was to go in and take some soil samples to see if the sediments were contaminated, because a lot of the estuaries have been used as industrial sites for over 100 years,
right.
And often they're abandoned. They may be derelict, and there could be some contaminants in the sediment, hydrocarbons, heavy metals. Once that's sorted out, then it's basically a fairly coarse-scale topographic reshaping using heavy equipment to give it the natural
wow.
shape of the land, because often it was altered for docks and ramps and things like that, so push it back to what it used to be, and then bring in large wood and remove any invasive plants, and then start revegetating it with native vegetation.
My goodness, that sounds like a big job.
It is. It uses the same amount of force that was used to deconstruct it in the first place, and that's why ecological restoration are not shy about having excavators and bulldozers and things like that. We leave the tweezers for the latter stages of the process.
Well, we're getting calls on this already. A lot of people want to tell us where they could see rewilding happen or where they're seeing it happen already in their community. Love to hear from you. Give us a call. What examples of rewilding are you seeing, and how much land, money, and resources do you think we should set aside for rewilding around the province? You can call us now, 1-800-825-5950. In the Lower Mainland, 604-669-3733. On your cell phone, star or pound 690. My guest is Ken Ashley, who is director of the Rivers Institute and instructor in ecological restoration at VCIT. In a few moments, we'll speak with author J.B. McKinnon as well. But for now, let's go to the phones. And John is on the line from Abbotsford. Good afternoon, John.
Hello.
Hi there. What would you like to say about rewilding?
Just that it's a very timely subject. We're looking in the Fraser Valley here at more and more land being utilized for our own purposes, and less being dedicated to all the other species on our planet that desperately need it. And so I'm with the Fraser Valley Conservancy, and we're looking, you know, actively at all these different concerns, and Seamless Mountain in Abbotsford is certainly one area that has a great deal of concern.
And so, have you started any work towards bringing in more biodiversity?
Well, what we do is as a sort of a land trust, what we do is we try to capture small pieces of land and then remove the invasives and reintroduce the species that are supposed to be there. And hence, you know, ideally, of course, make the area as wild as possible. I just feel that you know, our one species so completely dominates the environment at the expense of all others. It seems so selfish. And at the same time, we diminish our own, you know, the value of our environment that we enjoy. We diminish it every time we remove another species. So absolutely, this is essential, yeah.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, John.
Right.
Good to hear from you. And let's go up to Fort St. John now, and Esther is on the line. Good afternoon, Esther.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to say about rewilding?
Well, I would like to say that I think that we should be in the Peace area. We should be preserving the Peace River Valley for wildlife. You know, as you probably are aware, there's a lot of oil and gas development up here and forestry and mining. The animals, the wildlife seems to get chased down into this valley. So I think it should be preserved.
Thanks very much for the call, Esther. Ken Ashley, you've been listening to some of the comments, and Esther is calling from the Peace River Valley, talking about oil and gas development. It's, of course, where the Site C Dam is going to be built, it sounds like. So how do you balance that? How do you balance the need for rewilding, for restoration of that kind of biodiversity and habitat with industry?
That's a great question, and it's a fine balance. And there are some local examples where it's worked to various degrees. One place where it's working quite well is out in Delta, where the Delta Farmlands and Wildlife Trust, they actually encourage some farmers to leave fields fallow for several years and that they're not used, and they plant native species in there, native plant species, so that you get the small voles and mice-like critters running around in there, and then you get the birds and raptors in there. There's no herbicides or anything applied, and so you get sort of a rotational crop where you can actually have, you know, intensive agriculture, you know, close by, but also with essentially, you know, rewilded portions, and those are rotated through time, and that's worked pretty well. When you have industrial activity where you create, say, a reservoir, like the W.A.C. Bennett Dam created the Williston Reservoir, the various big reservoirs in the Kootenays, there have been compensation programs that were negotiated to, in lieu of the flooded land, the valley bottom land, and they turn out in sort of a cash allocation that's granted in perpetuity. And, you know, they work to some degree, but in some cases, like certainly in the Kootenays, I mean, there's no replacing valley bottom land. I mean, that's where the large ungulates want to be in the wintertime. And so at some point, there is a net loss that you can't compensate for.
Well, let's hear now from the Y2Y project. This is one of the most ambitious rewilding projects in Canada, North America, and possibly the world. It crosses through British Columbia. It is called Y2Y, or the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservative Initiative, and it's been in the works for many years now. Harvey Locke is one of its co-founders and current strategic advisor, and he joins us now on the line. Good afternoon to you, Harvey.
Good afternoon.
Can you explain Y2Y further for us?
Sure. The Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative is an idea of interconnecting the grand national parks like Yellowstone and Waterton Glacier and Banff and Jasper up into the Musco-Kachika of northern British Columbia and onto the Nahanni in the Northwest Territories and the Peel Watershed in the Yukon. And the idea is that that's the scale that we need to think of that nature operates at. We need to protect about half the region in an interconnected way. We have a very big head start here because some of the world's most iconic national parks were created some time ago by great visionaries, but we have more work to do now, and that's what we're busy doing.
And it is such a vast swath of land you're talking about. Is there much change when you go through the various areas from Yellowstone to the Yukon, or how would you describe the way that changes throughout?
Well, there are basically three conditions. So when you start in the Peel watershed of the Yukon or the Northwest Territories or even the Liard River in northern British Columbia, you're dealing with an extremely wild area, some of the wildest areas in the world. It doesn't need to be rewild. It needs to be kept wild. When you get to the Peace River break, you're getting into this ridiculous idea of the Site C Dam, which frankly must be stopped at all costs if we really care about nature in Canada. That will fragment the whole system. It's a terrible idea. And then as you come south through Banff and Jasper, you have conditions that are quite wild, quite good, but that we really need to think about how they connect to the broader landscape. And as you get south of Waterton Glacier, and in that area, you're into actually restoration or some rewilding is necessary there. So there's basically the three conditions of landscape condition where you still have hope, but the degrees of management shift according to where you are geographically.
And so what's involved with your project?
Well, an example of something that I think is really exciting is the idea of working to connect the landscape between Waterton Glacier and the Flathead Valley of British Columbia, which is, from a biodiversity point of view, probably the most important valley to protect in North America, to connect the Flathead Valley up to Banff National Park and to deal with things like how animals get across Highway 3 near Fernie and Sparwood, to deal with private land management and align forestry and mining in that landscape so that we can reconcile the world-class values there, such as very important metallurgical coal mining, there's important logging, but there's also incredibly important fisheries, wildlife, water quality, and wilderness values there. We need to start reconciling these things and thinking about what kind of world we want to live in instead of just watching it unravel because one more project comes and one more project comes. And this is the key thing about, you mentioned also the idea of Nature Needs Half and E.L. Wilson's book, and that's something I work on around the world. It's the idea that what kind of world do we want to live in? A world full of nature and full of life, or do we just want to continue to watch it unravel, hit these thresholds, and then watch things disappear? And many of us don't want to see a diminished world. Well, we want to see a vibrant world.
You mentioned your opposition to the Site C Dam. The province would argue it's essential to meeting our energy needs. And just today, a court injunction application to stop the construction of the dam has been turned down. So how do you, I guess it looks like the project is going to go ahead. So how do you go about your project, the Y2Y project, and allow for the Site C Dam to be built as well?
Well, you know, the fight over the Site C Dam hasn't stopped because a court injunction failed. Court injunctions, I was once a lawyer, extremely difficult to get for good reasons. It doesn't mean that it's still it's a good project. It means that the injunction failed. That's all it means. That project is an ecological catastrophe and simply should not happen, and it needs to be continued to be resisted and changes occur. And it's one of the things that's so important for us to remember is, and your first guest talked about it, these low elevation valley bottoms where there's rivers are the ecological heart of the entire landscape. The incredibly beautiful Peace River Valley below Fort St. John, if you've ever been there, it's one of the really extraordinary natural sites in British Columbia. They're going to put a wall up there, dam it, flood it, and not only destroy all the thing under the water, but it also has an enormous downstream effect. It's just not a good idea. And we also need to get over the idea that hydroelectricity is green energy. It's not at all. It's incredibly destructive to nature. And when we're dealing with climate change, we need to maintain the resilience of nature, and no place is more important than riparian corridors and intact river systems for that resilience of nature. So Site C is wrong for about 10 reasons, but most importantly, we're moving in the wrong direction. British Columbia has already been really badly damaged by giant hydro projects. We don't need another one.
All right. Well, thanks so much for telling us about your vast, ambitious project, Harvey.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for being interested.
Take care. Harvey Locke is one of the co-founders of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. It's about 12 minutes to 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock in the Mountain Time Zone here on BC Almanac. I'm Michelle Elliott sitting in for Gloria Makarenko, and we are talking about rewilding and what examples of rewilding have you seen in your part of the province? How much land or money or resources should be set aside for rewilding. Around the province, 1-800-825-5950. In the Lower Mainland, 604-669-3733. On your cell phone, star or pound 690. And my guest is Ken Ashley, who's the director of the Rivers Institute. Let's go back to the phones now, and Deb is on the line from Delta. Good afternoon, Deb.
Good afternoon.
Hi, what examples have you seen?
In North Delta, where I'm a volunteer with Cougar Creek Streamkeepers, we have 19 rain gardens, which are partnerships with the Delta School District and the Corporation of Delta, the engineering department. A rain garden is taking rainwater runoff from an impervious surface, such as a parking lot or a street or a roof, so that instead of piping that water straight into our local creeks, for example, Cougar Creek, which is a salmon stream, and sending it instantly out to the ocean, instead you soak that rainwater into the ground in your rain garden. The garden uses the water to grow the plants that the kids have planted, and we're talking pretty big gardens. Some of them are about a block long, so trees and shrubs, sometimes native plants, sometimes a mixture of native and domestic plants. So instead of wasting that water, you are putting it into the ground. The plants use what they need, and you're also replenishing the groundwater. I think this is so important with the drought. I got involved in this because we wanted to reduce pollution of Cougar Creek by stormwater runoff from parking lots. It's a huge source of hydrocarbon pollution, cigarette butts, and so on. But now, with the summer drought, I see that the water conservation aspect has become even more important. We need to get that water back in the ground, especially if we're going to be pumping groundwater. You can't keep pumping it out of the bank unless you keep putting deposits back in, and those deposits are what nature designed, which is it rains and the water soaks into the ground.
Well, this sounds like an amazing project, Deb.
It's really exciting to work with the kids and introduce them to the concept of rain gardens. And they are also beautification projects because it makes the entrance to the school look nicer. So it introduces the community to the idea that rainwater isn't this kind of inconvenience that we should be sluicing down drains everywhere you look.
We're certainly not thinking
drains.
That now.
No, all right. Exactly. This summer's been great for getting the idea of rain gardens across.
Thanks so much for the call and letting us know about your project in Delta.
Thank you.
That's Deb in Delta. Well, let's hear now from J.B. McKinnon, who is the author of The Once and Future World, Nature as It Was, As It Is, As It Could Be. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
J.B., your first book, quite a seminal book, The 100-Mile Diet, was focused on thinking about local food and where food comes from. Why did you want to write about rewilding?
Well, the one actually led to the other because I was looking at how people managed to live off the landscape in good numbers in the past, and I'm talking about the First Nations here, and what I realized was that the reason they were able to do that was because they lived in a much more abundant natural environment than we're aware of today. And it really opened my eyes to the fact that even in Canada, where I think we tend to think we're surrounded by kind of near pristine wild nature, we've lost a lot in this country.
You've heard a few examples here from some of our callers about what they're doing in their community. What is your advice? How does a community decide if a rewilding project is right for them? How do they start?
Well, I think usually a lot of the work, I mean, in most communities in British Columbia, there are people doing this kind of work, organizations like Harvey's and Ken's, and they've often done a lot of the hard work ahead of time. But I think ultimately it comes down to, we have to have conversations as communities about, as Harvey said, the kind of natural world that we want to surround ourselves with. Do we want to be surrounded by a simplified and degraded natural environment? Or do we want to live with something, a little more uplifting and a little more resilient than that? And, one thing that I've noticed in looking at this around the world is that one of the places where rewilding is really a hot topic is in Europe. And the reason for that is that people there wake up every day and are able to see very clearly that they are, that they have lost most of their ecological wealth. And luckily we haven't gone so far down that road, but it's instructive to look at Europe and realize, if you just keep losing things, then eventually you start to really want them back.
So for us here in British Columbia, what do you see as the biggest challenge in the way of rewilding?
I think probably the biggest challenge is that perception that we have in British Columbia, that I think there's still this lingering perception that we have an endless wilderness out there, that we can keep logging, we can keep fishing, we can keep, getting out there and drilling more and expanding expanding industry into every corner of the province. And it's just not the case anymore. You know, at this point, we really need to be looking at how we can make the ecology and the economy work together. That seems to be, very clearly the future in terms of a sustainable future for the province and the world. And it has this additional benefit of, we, instead of watching the world get worse and worse and fall apart around us, we can breathe some life into it and actually watch it get better and better, more dramatic and more magical to live in.
JB, it's great to hear from you this afternoon. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
JB McKinnon is the author of The Once and Future World, Nature as It Was, as It Is, as It Could Be. Let's go back to the phones, and Todd is calling us from the Kispiox Valley. Good afternoon, Todd.
Hi there.
Hi. What would you like to tell us about rewilding?
Well, I want to say two things. So first of all, my father is Dr. John Stockner. He's a colleague of Ken Ashley's. And I wanted to point out...
He's nodding, okay.
Yeah, and Dad did a lot of important work in Howe Sound on the Strait of Georgia back in the late 70s and 80s. On the water quality, he and several of his colleagues were able to identify the pollution from the pulp mills and the Britannia mine as being definitely destructive to the water quality and ecology of those areas. And as a consequence, stronger regulations and environmental law was brought into place to clean the water up. So the people who are benefiting now from the whales and dolphins and the megafauna that they're seeing in the waters around Vancouver and Howe Sound have strong science to thank for it. And what's ironic is that in this era that we live in right now, with the current federal government decimating virtually every environmental we're kind of going backwards. And that's the problem, is that, and somebody, one of your earlier comments talked about not so much rewilding,
Okay, I think someone is coughing there in the background, Todd, but I certainly do recall all the concerns about contamination from the Britannia mine. Thanks so much for the call. I have just a little bit of time to include Ani from Vancouver. Hi there, Ani.
Hello, good afternoon.
Hi. Quickly, what would you like to say?
I want to say that if we humans get out of the way, nature will come back. I watched a BBC documentary several years ago about the green space between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, and there was no one living on it. It was strictly green space, and the wild came back. The creatures that lived in the space came back. So we just have to get out of the way, and nature will happen.
It's not insurmountable. Thank you for the call, Ani.
Bye.
Ken Ashley, director of the Rivers Institute, realistically, how far do you see rewilding going?
Well, there's really no limits to it. It's a new emerging science, but as you can tell from the callers, there's a lot of interest in it, and that's why at BCIT and Simon Fraser University, we're just starting a graduate program. A master's degree in ecological restoration starts in 2 weeks, which is really to meet the demand of this emerging profession. So there's a lot of emerging science, but on the other hand, there's the 800-pound gorilla in the room is climate change, and you can't sort of tinker around the edges without addressing climate change, and that's really going to come down to what happens in December in Paris with the meetings, and even the Pope has weighed in on it in his encyclical that he published recently, of which the majority of it was that you have to address climate change because of all the other aspects it spins off in terms of poverty and things like that. So if we can get a handle on climate change, then I think there's no limit to the upside of rewilding. If that's not done, then the changes that we'll see on our planet due to sort of runaway climate change could essentially undo everything we're trying to do.
It's great to have you this afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
That's Ken Ashley, who's director of the Rivers Institute and an instructor in ecological restoration at BCIT.